meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide. The winds have changed.
Millennia ago, from a little cave on a tiny island of Patmos in the Aegean Sea, the heavens opened and a vision was revealed. Since then, the world has been fascinated by the cosmic upheaval brewing in the horizon of history. The upheaval is now upon us. It is within us. To some degree, it has always been. But there has been a sudden and violent shift in the affairs of the world. The winds have changed. Heaven will not be silent. Let us now join Father Anthony Bush, pastor of St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy, and author of A Mother's Plea, For the Winds Have Changed. Together, we can pave the way for a hopeful response to the signs of our times.
Good afternoon. Let's look for those signs of the times. That's a great intro, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Good to see you, Tony.
Same here, Father.
Father Tom Coyce here with you on this wonderful hour. An hour of conversation, discussion into the wide world around us, especially with our Catholic frame of mind, Christian, welcoming all our non-Catholic, any listeners. We hope that the things that we talk about and winds of change are of interest to many people. I hope it even would draw someone who's not Catholic into taking maybe a second look, or maybe hopefully removing some of the perhaps negative prejudice that people have about Catholicism. I think that happens at times, right?
Yep. You know,
I love the line from Fulton Sheehan of long ago, who used to say, no one is really angry at Catholicism. They're often angry at what they think Catholicism is.
Yeah,
there's a lot of misunderstanding of what we are.
Too early for that.
Was that was that someone being a little frustrated?
That happens later on.
Yeah, yeah.
We should put the warning on. You have to listen to the whole show.
Right. And Nick will join in when he sees the opportunity to. God bless you. I shout out my little tweet this morning about, at least to begin with, this is going to be a hard topic to keep in a little box.
Just that little bit of information has got me really intrigued.
You did see the little...
I did.
It was a line from, for those who get at my little emails through Flock Notes. Mm-hmm. It's not tweet. I say tweet, but that's not it. Flock.
It's better than tweet.
It's better than tweet. It really is. And I appreciate those who are working with this little company called Flock Notes. They're really a good, strong Catholic group, and they know what parishes. They know what Catholic parishes are, and they know what we need, we want, et cetera, et cetera. So God love you, all those at Flock Notes. But anyways, the theme for today is something that an old philosophy teacher used to drill into us over and over again. And it's still, you know how some things that stick in your mind, you know, and this is 40 years later. So it must have been profound, right?
Mm-hmm.
It must have been good. And I do think it's profound, but it has to be unpacked, and it could be applied to a lot of the themes that we talk about here with the being Catholic in America, the difficult dilemma between being loyal to a nation, being loyal to a civil body versus loyal to a religious body, a church versus your political party, government versus the church, et cetera, et cetera. The things are always at play, and they have been at play. And so that's why I just think it's a theme that we keep bouncing about, and I don't think we'll ever run out of it, as it were. But the philosophical principle that a professor by the name of Thomas Prufer, bless his heart, the Lord took him. He's not with us anymore, but he was somewhat had quite a good of a reputation in his time and in his field and everything. But he used to tell us, remember boys and girls, although I think most of us were men in the class. We didn't have too many women philosophers in our philosophy classes. It was mostly South Seminarians. He said, remember, your beginning is not the beginning.
That's good.
That's a kind of a good way.
It's pretty deep.
It's kind of deep, yeah. And the more I think about it, what was he trying to impress on us? You know, on the one hand, he was just trying to make us realize we are in a world, we're passing through time. We have a segment of time. So much of who we are is because of those who were before us, which we don't think of that so much. Mm-hmm. He was trying to get us to be curious, to be desirous of knowing what others before us have said, what they've thought, how those thoughts lead to actions, etc. And you know, it came to me. I'm going to apply this to American history and our Catholic faith and Christianity in general, as it were, in a great conflict between within the Christian world, namely the conflicts that exist between Catholics and Protestants, basically. First, between Protestants and Protestants, and then as a body, Protestants versus the body of Catholics. Although within Catholicism, there's certainly a lot of conflict, and there isn't by no means a kind of uniformity that I think people assume or think exists, what have you. Getting to that, remember, your beginning is not the beginning. And the way I like to bring this to life is that I think one of the great anxieties of teenagers, okay, let's try to go back and remember our teenage life. Those of you who are yet to be teenagers, you'll have to think ahead, you know, but probably most of our listeners are beyond teenage life, right? That was just a couple years ago for you, right?
Yeah, Johnny? Exactly.
Just about 4 or 5 for me. But anyways, I really think when you think of anxieties that often preoccupy a teenager's life, it would be things like, she said, did you hear what she said about so-and-so in the cafeteria? You know? Or maybe another preoccupation is, how am I gonna get good enough grades to get into college? You know, another obvious, typical young person's mm-hmm. anxieties. Or even conflicts with mom and dad, of course. As young people grow up and as they get new friends and they start driving or they have friends around town and what have you, and they're going here and there, oftentimes parents have conflicts. Young people have conflicts with their children. And it's so very obvious to me, in a sense, that a young teenager oftentimes will not remember that his beginning is not the beginning. My world starts with me when I was born, and now another way you can translate this philosophical principle is, remember, your world is not the world. Because it's kind of in the same genre, elaborating on what Professor Prufer said to us. Remember, your world is not the world. We are constantly confronted with the problems of our world, right? And what mm-hmm. else? And going back to the example of a teenager, when his world is all messed up, they are in a great deal of anxiety, you know? Maybe not just teenagers, anybody's.
Could really apply to anybody.
It really could. I think it's focused. It's sort of on display a little bit more in young people, because the parent will say, "Hey, give it time. You know, you're young yet. There's so much more of life ahead of you. If this friend or this job doesn't work out, you know, give it some time and realize." And then the wisdom that the parents have is often rejected by the younger generation. They think that they have sort of discovered the true way of liberation beyond what the parents have learned. And that principle, remember, your world is not the world. Keep on expanding your horizons. Keep on, which is different than, there's something similar that's very popular with young people, but young people, anybody who's young who's listening to me now, take note of this, please. Please take note of this. When I say, as a priest, trying to give some advice about life and say, remember, your world is not the world. You must expand your horizons. Please know that that's not the same as just try anything. Do you know what I'm saying? Young people will like to say, it sounds almost, it's similar, but it's not. I'll try anything once, you know, or I'll go traveling. I'll go here. I'll go there. There's a kind of that spirit of adventurism that young people have, which is a good thing. You know, that's a good. It does expand their horizons. But when it's translated to mean, well, I'll try anything once, you abandon yourself. You ignore the wisdom that has come before you. In other words, I'll try anything once. Is kind of like a bridge builder saying, you know, I'll try any material to build this bridge. And of course, that's a pretty stupid architect.
Exactly.
If he's going to reject the wisdom of all the other architects that have gone before him and built many bridges. I was watching a Discovery Channel the other day on building bridges. Those are fascinating.
It is.
Fascinating structures, aren't they? Mm-hmm. Especially huge, big bridges. A good architect wouldn't say, I'll try anything once for this project. He should, or she, female architect, of course, could be, he or she should consult and study well all that has been learned by architects of the past. You have to apply many mathematical principles to your bridge and consult the manufacturers of different kinds of materials. And so a wise bridge builder doesn't have to start from scratch, and he's not going to just say, well, I'll try everything once. Like, kind of to continue the scientific analogy, like Thomas Edison famously, I remember learning as a boy, Thomas Edison tried hundreds and hundreds of different filaments before he invented the electric light bulb, you know. He was just trying everything because the electric light bulb hadn't been invented yet, and he was hoping to be able to keep light and without having the kerosene lamps that were popular, of course, in the day. And so now that he achieved the invention of the light bulb, all new scientists, if they're smart, are not going to say, I'll try anything. You say, wait a minute, he's tried 1,000 different ones, and we all know these don't work, so let's learn from that wisdom of the past. So young people have this sense in their hearts that, I'll try anything once, meaning don't try to give me any of your wisdom from the there was a saying that was popular when I was a younger teenager whippersnapper that said, don't trust anyone over 30, which is kind of, that was a whole generation kind of grew up with that.
Yeah, that doesn't make sense.
Yeah, but it
did back then.
It did back then. It was a rebellious spirit.
Right.
And unfortunately, those who were saying that when they're in their 20s are now in their 50s and 60s running a lot of the country in some pretty high offices, I might want to point out, and they haven't discovered the error of that particular way of looking at life. Do you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So anyways, I do want to apply this theory. Remember that your beginning is not the beginning, and pat on the back a Catholic principle that our country needs today, and especially vis-a-vis the kind of Protestant spirituality, theology, psychology that has been a part of the American experiment. Remember I was using that term, American experiment, Tony? We got to come back to this. I've got to take a quick break. But when I brought that term up and I said, have you used that? You were kind of like, it wasn't a familiar phrase to you. And I remember I was driving back home and I was, oh my gosh, we got to talk about that more. You know, it is a significant concept of being here in America and applying God's truth and value and the revelation we get from Jesus Christ to it. So anyways, we'll come back. And I want to say how there's a light of Catholicism and there's a brightness to Catholicism that our nation, our country desperately needs at this point. So I'm Father Tom Coyes, sitting in for Father Anthony Bush. You're listening to listener-supported The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
Winds of Change broadcasts from the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy at the historic St. Stanislaus Kostka Church, located two blocks north off Division on Noble at the Division Street exit off the Kennedy. Since 1867, St. Stanislaus Kostka Church has been serving the faithful of Chicagoland since 1867. With your help, St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy, can continue its mission to bring Christ to His people. Please donate now by going to sanctuaryofthedivinemercy.org. That's sanctuaryofthedivinemercy.org. And click on the donations link to make a secure donation with a major credit card or debit card. With your help, St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy, will continue its restoration and will continue to thrive for the body of Christ. The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ and on the World Wide Web at windsofchangeshow.com.
This year, our nation celebrates the 150th anniversary of the ending of our Civil War. What lessons can we learn from history? Does Abraham Lincoln's wisdom apply to today? Was Jefferson Davis really so wrong? Plan to come to St. James at Sag Bridge, Lamont, Illinois, Sunday, June 14th, Flag Day, for a unique Civil War reenactment you won't soon forget. Come and sit in the oldest church in Northern Illinois and listen as Father Robert Miller and Father Tom Coyes bring Bishop Augustine Barreau of Florida and Archbishop John Baptiste Purcell of Ohio to life as they reenact their actual 1860 sermons. Gates open at 1:30. The drama begins at 2 p.m. Burgers and Civil War era treats will be available for purchase. Bring the whole family. Learn about the ideas behind the bullets.
Welcome back, everyone. I thank you for that little ad for St. James reenactment. Burgers and bullets.
Love it.
That's the way. And I have to tell you, we're going to have some tables there with Civil War treats. One of the Civil War treats, so any of you people who are Civil War buffs will know the term hardtack. Those are like little crackers that the soldiers put in their backpacks and carried with them, you know, and they're and there's a company. I was so shocked to find out there's a company that makes those things.
Wow.
So if you come to St. James on Sunday, June 14th, it will be a beautiful sunny day. I'm praying. Lord, we're doing your work, so please help us. I love that little prayer. Lord, we're trying to do your work. Would you cooperate? Can we work together here? Work with me. It's good prayer, my friends, when you're trying to do something for the Lord. Just say, work with me, Lord. He'll listen to you. But so this company that makes these crackers called Hardtack is the same company that made them back in the Civil War.
Wow.
It's out from the East Coast, and I found out on the website where you can get Hardtack, and it's the same company that made them back then, and they're still making them now. They also make regular crackers. Mm-hmm. Thank goodness they came up with a new line, because I ordered some, we got them, and I tasted one, and They're not going to put Oreo cookies out of business. I'm quite sure about that. They're kind of...
But it puts you in a mood, which is the good thing.
That's what it is. Mood setting. You want to know and you want to... So you want to feel and taste what it was like back in that time, you know? That's actually one of the things that motivates people to go to Civil War reenactments. You wonder what it was like back then, you know? The sacrifices were tremendous and the life was difficult, and you want to know a little bit, but you don't want to know too much, right. You know? It's like, okay, I want to experience a little bit, but give me my nice air-conditioned room and my computer and my laptop and all the rest. But anyways, Hardtack will be available.
Good to know.
Out there. And really... It was a gnawing thought in my heart and mind when I would go to reenactments. A couple of years ago, was it last year? Last year, I was out to Gettysburg, the battlefield in Pennsylvania, for the 150th anniversary of that battle. And it's obviously mostly about reenacting how the two armies lined up against each other and how many were killed and what they... where they moved and where they were positioned and all that. All the military strategy, which I got to admit is interesting, at least for guys. I find men are much more interested than women. And in that sense, I don't mean that women should be more interested in it. I'm glad they're beyond it in a sense. There's something a little bit sick about just being fascinated by the way people kill each other. I think and this is what drove me to try to bring this different, unique kind of reenactment out, is that I wanted to know why people killed each other, not how they killed each other.
Why?
You know, every war comes up with new hows. But why is so very important. Because if you can figure out why, don't you think you can figure out a little bit of how to avoid the next one in one way or
That's
another?
That's true. I don't think you can really, really know why, but it gives you an insight in what's going on at the time.
Yeah.
And it's what I look at it as.
And you won't completely be able to...
know why.
Understand fully. Only in heaven do we fully learn and understand everything. Mm-hmm. But you certainly can have a better insight. And those insights should teach us. If we don't learn from experience, we will never learn at all.
Exactly.
And that's there's also something that bugs me, and that is when looking at history, you are supposed to forget about moral principles. In other words, you can't judge one side or another. And certainly, in one way, you don't want to judge people to condemn them. You don't want to condemn... Jesus says, condemn no one, which means people of today just as much as yesterday of history. We're not there to condemn, but we do need to judge, to find out what was right and what was wrong. And that's what, that's one of the reasons I'm passionate about this St. James Civil War reenactment coming up in June. Anyways, where were we? We were talking about the principle from my philosophy teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Tony, I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit because
okay.
that's the, I want to see if, trying to unpack it when he says, remember, your beginning is not the beginning, or your world is not the world. Does that make sense? Do you find, you have to break out of it in a certain sense?
It's humbling. When I think about it, it's one of the flock note, I've been thinking about it since, and now that you're talking about it, we're such a small part of a big picture.
Yeah.
That's what I think. When you think about your beginning, it's so small compared to what everything else is going on. That's the way I look at it.
I think it gives you, if you really understand that quote, it gives you a sort of stability in life or a steadiness, you know, as opposed to really being angry or even really being ecstatic, you know, you'll say, okay, well, yeah, things will. Remember the story in the Bible where, which king was it? Maybe King Solomon. He was he asked one of his sages, his wise priests, to give him something that would help him throughout his life, to calm him down. And they produced a ring that he would wear. And remember what was written on that ring? It said, remember, this too shall pass. Yeah, it's a good thing to have. When you're deep down and depressed, remember, this will pass. When you're ecstatic and high and happy, remember, this too will pass. You know, I used to think some people, one of my favorite professors, Ralph McInerney, he taught at Notre Dame for a while. I didn't have him in class, but I knew him well enough and saw him at a number of conferences. And he was a kind of a English man who always had a certain kind of sophistication to him, and he never seemed to veer too much up or down, left or right. He seemed to be always the same whenever you met him and whenever he was talking about.
That's good.
You know, he had a steadiness, you know. Mm-hmm. And I was, as a younger person, I kind of misinterpreted that for just kind of a boring personality. You know, you look at, oh, Dr. McInerney, your pants are on fire. Well, look at that. They indeed are. Maybe we should call someone
do something about that,
you know. We kind of joked about him in that way, you know, and he was, maybe we all know some people like that a bit.
Yeah.
I'm trying to sing the virtues. I'm trying to praise him mm-hmm. in the sense that he took that advice to heart. Remember, this too shall pass. And the thing I wanted to relate it to American history is I believe the Protestant kind of theology that is at the forefront of American history, which was part of the American Revolution, they were setting a new world. They were creating a new world. Why? Because the old world, i.e. Europe, had failed them. And it was, in their minds and hearts, a tremendous failure, a great colossal mistake in a lot of ways. So we're gonna start over again. And here's where I think they make a mistake, where it's always good. It's good at, there's a certain way of starting over again with a fresh slate. We say that, you know, okay, let's start over again with a fresh slate. We do that in relationships, you know, I think quite a bit, and there's a goodness to that. Yet there's a gnawing sense of, you can't escape the past. You're not starting tabla rasa. The Protestant pilgrims who came here were fooling themselves to some extent by thinking they're starting the history of mankind over again. And there are writers and there are people who say, we are the new Adam, the new Eve. America is the new Israel. That was a famous kind of image. Just as God led the Israelites out of Egypt through the Red Sea to establish the Promised Land, so many of the immigrants saw America as a new beginning like that too. Leaving Egypt was leaving Europe. Going across the Red Sea was going across the Atlantic Ocean. Establishing the Promised Land was establishing the United States and much of the New World. This could be true down south in Mexico and South America as well.
I never looked at it that way, but that is exactly right.
That's what a lot of folks will. And there are writings, mm-hmm. you know, about that. And even some of our prayers within the Mass reference to it. And there is a beauty to it. Because there were some corrupt things going on. And yet it would be a mistake to think that Christianity. Here's the point I want to make. In terms of where I think Catholicism shines a bright light into our weird world of today, in the sense that Catholicism is always forcing us to expand our horizon, think bigger, think back farther, think wider than your own town or even own nation. Think, with a popular term today, think globally, which is so popular today, which is usually just used in reference to natural resources or global warming or climate change or something, or you must think globally. But Catholicism is the inventor of thinking globally. And yet so many of the people who are of the, so to speak, political left, who would put a bumper sticker on their back car saying think globally, would probably reject most of the things that Catholicism stands for. You know, and I want to say here, no, wait a minute, think globally, you're tapping into something that's incredibly Catholic sounding. And this is one of the geniuses of Pope John Paul II with the theology of the body. We're calling for another break. I got to make this connection for our wonderful listeners. Stay tuned, my friends, because it's getting a little deeper, and I promise to wrinkle your brain a little bit more when we come back from the break. I'm Father Tom Coy, sitting in for Father Anthony Bush. You're listening to listener-supported The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
You've heard us say that Winds of Change is listener-supported. That means you help us stay on the air with your dollars and your prayers. And we are asking for that help now. Please take a moment and go to our website, windsofchangeshow.com. That's windsofchangeshow.com. On the upper right-hand side of the page, there is a link. Support Winds of Change Show. Click on that link and donate securely with any major credit card. With your help, Winds of Change will continue to bring you the truth. The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ and on the World Wide Web at windsofchangeshow.com.
Watch out! He is showing us his flesh. I am Father Thomas J. Loy with a Theology of the Body moment for Tabor Life Institute. God has taken on our flesh, and during the Feast of the Epiphany, God shows his flesh to the world. In the Western Lung of the Church, God is showing this to the wise men. The Eastern Lung, having just celebrated the circumcision of Christ's flesh, now speaks of Christ's naked flesh during his baptism in the Jordan River. In the East, Epiphany is also called Theophany. So why all this flesh? Because the flesh of Jesus Christ reveals his divinity and the truth about being human. This is the theology of the body. Christ's birth, epiphany, and baptism in the flesh has renewed all creation. And if this is real to us, how do we now see all of creation, especially human body persons? To find out more about the theology of the body, visit taborlife.org. Taborlife.org.
Hey, well, I'm glad that little ad from Father Aloy's theology of the body was right there at the end of this break, because before the break, I want to relate something that I'm trying to say, this philosophical principle. Remember, my friends, your beginning is not the beginning. Or to paraphrase a little bit, remember, your world is not the world. It's humbling, right?
And it is.
And it breaks it. It's something that's fundamental in John Paul II's theology of the body. We all know that, I hope we all know that it's a way of looking at our bodily lives in connection to our sexual lives, trying to make the Catholic Church's teaching on marriage so understandable and so beautiful and so reasonable. One of the corner pins of his theology of the body, which doesn't get that much attention, is to what he calls original innocence. Original innocence, which is a reflection on Adam and Eve before they ate the apple. And it's so powerful. And Pope John Paul II wants us to think of it not in just mythical terms. He wants us to think of it as real in the sense of history. It's historical. But it's such a radical change between the time of Adam and Eve before they sinned and turned away from God, and God punishes the human race vis-a-vis Adam and Eve, and all the time from Adam and Eve until today. He says you can't understand our Catholic moral or ethical principles if you don't look at time differently. Namely, that you have to see that he calls it historical man. We are living in the time of historical man, which is the time from the fall to the second coming. That's basically all of human history, like what when you go to a history class and you have a history teacher standing up in front of you and he says, okay, now class, we're going to study history. What he's going to teach you about is historical man in terms of what John Paul II is trying to teach us, as St. John Paul II is trying to reveal more of what's in the Bible, what's in the story of creation. Because when you're sitting in a history class and you're learning about the history of man, which is very, very wonderful. That's what I like to do a lot here on Winds of Change, as some of you know. Mm-hmm. And it's very important. Yet you won't go to a history class and the teacher will say, now we're going to study the history of Adam and Eve before they ate the apple. Well, number one, there's no books written about him in that time, you know, and you could say, oh, well, that's because there's nothing written about him, then it didn't exist. The Pope says, no, you can't say it didn't exist. You have to take it as real. If there was an Adam and Eve, which there was, and if they sinned, which they did, and if God punished them, which he did, then there was a time, a real time, before the fall, and that's called the original state of innocence. And that's so very important for John Paul II as he's trying to explain Catholic moral sexual morality. It's because he's trying to say, hey, the way God originally created it, that's where you're going to find the fingerprint of God. That's where you're going to find nature in its beautiful created form. And so we're trying to recapture it. We're not just managing the fallen nature. So the Catholic, when I say remember your beginning is not the beginning, I want to say for Americans, let us say, remember the history of Christianity didn't begin in 1776. There's 1,700 years before that. Here's a good example that comes to mind too. As I'm preparing for this Civil War reenactment thing, I've been investigating some of the arguments of the Southern Confederacy, of course. And the Southern Confederacy is saying, as part of their defense, slavery had been around ever since God lost his shoes. That's a location. You know, ever since, when I'm trying to say something is far away or someplace, I say where God lost his shoes. But anyways, at the beginning of time, let's say, since the dinosaurs, I don't think dinosaurs had slaves, but okay.
Before that.
Adam and Eve, maybe Cain and Abel, they started making slaves. Anyways, it goes, all of, that was part of the Confederacy's defense. They were, we should be allowed to keep our slaves because it's just been a part of human history. I want to say, knock, knock, can you look back into history for those other... Look at the history of Europe and realize that slavery, yes, was so dominant in human civilization, but Christianity did a darn good job of snuffing it out. It really, the Roman Empire didn't snuff out slavery. They went along pretty well with it. And the Muslim world and those empires and the Persian empires, they had slavery. But Christianity snuffed it out. There's other ways that people dominate others. Namely, you could say the feudal system grew up, and there are other ways of being dominant of humans over others. Yes, obviously, but that particular form of owning and buying slaves, it was tremendous accomplishment that Christianity kind of did away with slavery. As a matter of fact, the Canary Islands. They, when Columbus was going, you know, going across the Atlantic Ocean, thinking he was trying to find a way to the east, obviously the Canary Islands were discovered first because they're not far away from the shores of Europe. And the Pope, right away, as soon as those islands were discovered, the Pope had to come out with a statement, don't try to enslave those natives there, you know? I don't know fully the history of the slave issue, but I think it kind of worked. I think those natives that were discovered on the Canary Islands were not enslaved because the Christian spirit was enough alive, shall we say. But that's kind of a good sign of failing to see that your beginning is not the beginning. And a Catholic mentality is always pushing us to expand. And it's painful. It's difficult. It makes solving our problems more difficult. You know what I'm saying? Mm. So I don't know. Does this make any sense?
It does.
Tony? I want to maybe move to something else too. This will relate. Last week I was quoting from a wonderful article by a convert, an English priest, by the name of Father Dwight Longenecker. He's in the United States, down in South Carolina now, but he's an Englishman, and he's making reference to the German bishops, especially Cardinal Casper, who's kind of at the forefront, but there's many others, who are willing to liberalize Catholic practices that are connected to marriage in order to fill the pews, I guess, in order to keep the church going. I'm not sure exactly how to end that sentence, but there's definitely this movement. And this English priest, who's now an American, he's making an accusation that the German hierarchy is maybe becoming too Anglican. And you have to understand sort of the cultural context between Germany and England. Those are fighting words, you know. If you're going to accuse, don't we always do that? You know that when you want to insult or when you want to get someone's goat, you kind of morph your words to affect them the most. Mm. You know, there's some insults won't insult certain people. You got to come up with a new insult if you really want to get their goat. And so, I think by calling Cardinal Casper or the German hierarchy that's going in this liberal secular way, if you were to say, "Oh, you're just too liberal," or you're just going down the liberal progressive way, that's not a good insult. Because what's wrong with that? Can you? Okay, give me your next shot, you know. But if you say you're looking too Anglican, whoa, those are fighting words, you know.
Arms get raised, fist gets raised.
Yeah. You know, that's kind of another good little bit of wisdom for life, you know. Any of you who get angry,
it's me,
which is most of us, you know, try to dance around any of the insults that people do give you, you know, just sort of think of them in a different terms, you know. Try to overcome one with or if someone is used to giving you one insult, try to develop hard skin for that one. It's kind of like Superman. Remember, Superman was nothing could hurt him.
Except kryptonite,
you know. And it's like people who know us well.
Mm-hmm.
they know the kryptonite, right?
Oh, yeah.
Somebody who could, somebody who wants to really get us. The ones who know us best can get us best,
mm-hmm.
you know, because people who don't know, somebody could insult me this way or that way. It'll bounce off my chest like bullets on Superman's chest. But somebody who knows me well and knows the insult that'll call me this or call me that, get that kryptonite out of here. I can't resist. I'm gonna lash out. So know your kryptonite. I guess that's the lesson, my friends. Yep. Know your kryptonite and be prepared beforehand. But let's hear, I want to share a little bit more of this with them. Because he says, the English culture has drifted increasingly into atheism and agnosticism. And as English culture has moved towards multiculturalism and moral decay, so the Church of England, rather than changing the culture, most often conforms to the culture. For example, when abortion became legal in England back in 1967, the hierarchy of the Church of England did not raise much objection. In the years since, only the faintest of British voices have been raised in the pro-life cause. For the majority of Church of England bishops, it is a non-issue. Abortion rights are the law of the land, and that's it. Similarly, when divorce was made easy and cheap, few voices in the Church of England objected. And now same-sex marriage objectors in the Church of England will be silenced in a similar way by the establishment powers of church and state in collusion. It is safe to conclude that the Church of England is driven by every wind of cultural fashion and secular trend. Hey, there's the reference to our radio show, right? The winds of change. The winds of what we're referring to on the winds of change is the winds of the Holy Spirit. Am I right, Father Bush? If you're out there listening, God love you for all you've provided the people with this wonderful show. It is impossible not to conclude that part of the pressure of the hierarchy of the Church of England to conform is the fact that the wealth of the Church of England was created by the state and continues to be interwoven with the established status of the church. Should the church protest too much, they will be expelled from their palaces, churches, cathedrals, college chapels. Now here's where he gets into Germany. There are parallels to the Catholic Church in Germany. Is Cardinal Casper and his brother bishops too Anglican for comfort? Certainly the links with the state are close. As in England, religion is taught in the state schools. More than 30% of the population is Catholic. And the church tax, therefore, makes the Church of Germany the wealthiest church in Europe. While the Catholic Church in Germany claims independence from government control, the church's dependence on the church tax must cause concern. The fact that Catholics who elect not to pay the church tax are excommunicated is a scandal and must raise questions about the motivation for the German bishop's desire for a more relaxed marriage discipline, a soft line on same-sex marriage, and a frequently used laissez-faire approach to liturgy, evangelism, and ecumenism. Wow, isn't that... That's not just Germany and England. That's here.
Sounds like here.
Sounds like Chicago, doesn't mm-hmm. it? Yeah, it's that loyalty to the government or even a political party more so than the principles that we get in our Catholic faith. It's a temptation. Terrible temptation, because so often the temptation is connected to money, right? Mm-hmm. It's connected to some kind of financial. And isn't financial ruin one of life's greatest fears? Unless we can confront that, unless we can own that and realize that, we're kidding ourselves as to, you know, being great evangelists or great defenders of the faith, as it were. We're getting close to the end here, and I want to touch on something. Cardinal George, of blessed memory, I just love that guy. There were some so wise things that he said, and yet I want to do a whole show. One of these Wednesdays, I'm going to bring in some things. We're getting close to the end.
Make a note of that. That'd be a good show.
God, because I love I loved so much of what Cardinal George says, and yet I find something a little lacking, right? Or maybe I just want to push him in a certain direction he didn't go in, and maybe he would have gone in, but it didn't live long enough. He liked to be a bishop of the church, and I think this could be said of so many, that lived above the political battles of the day. You know, I certainly understand why you would want to. I certainly understand that Catholicism, qua Catholicism, I always like that little word, qua. That's another, it means like in a baseball, qua baseball is baseball as baseball, you know, the essence of baseball, you know. So I like to say Catholicism qua Catholicism can and should float above the political battles of the day. But what I'm a little afraid of is that if we float above the political battles of the day too much, we let the political powers influence all the country and all the culture and all the society, and we do a disservice by staying too much above it. It's almost as if, yes, it's nice to be able to live above it, but it's unfortunate that we can't. It's like, okay, maybe you leaders, you bishops, even I guess we could say priests or any of the hierarchy of the church, yeah, we could, but the ordinary person can't live outside of it. Or maybe I should say it this way. There are some in the political movements of the day that wish, that want people to sit on the sidelines. Don't bother us with any of your religious principles or thoughts.
Let us do what we want to do.
You're kind of giving a power over to another when you abandon. That's why I say you're living above the political fray. So I was listening to one of Father Bob Barron's YouTube, who I love listening to. He's such a wise, and he's a great guy, and he's doing so many good work. So on, too. But he was pushing the point of okay, we have to avoid getting into this. We have to be outside of the political world. And I'm afraid that a bit of advice is counterproductive, in a sense. He was saying in this little interview that he was giving that Cardinal George didn't like to be pinned, labeled. I don't think most of us like to be labeled much. He didn't want to be labeled a conservative. He didn't want to be labeled a liberal. But in some ways, I want to say, don't be afraid of being labeled a little bit for the sake of the world that you're living in today. Catholicism that is in America, not Catholicism qua Catholicism that goes everywhere, but we are not everywhere. We are here, and we're supposed to bring our faith into the voting booth, shall we say, and into the public square. That there are many who would want us to be completely sidelined and sidetracked. That would suit them just fine. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that's being a fully... I don't know if I'm making myself clear here.
I'm thinking, too, because, I teeter-totter on that, too, where, you know, you kind of want to just say, forget it all.
Yeah.
I don't want to be a part of this. But then by doing that, you give your, you know, you don't say it. And then...
Yeah.
The world just goes on, and it's going on in a bad way, in a sense.
Right.
If you don't care, if you don't participate, have to participate.
There's a great line from Archbishop Purcell, who's the Civil War bishop that I'm going to be playing on this the reenactment. He says, "Beware those who do not elect to be your neighbor's keeper, live in danger of being your neighbor's victim. You know, that's so cool. Keep an eye on your neighbor. In other words, to stay out of business, stay out of everyone's business doesn't always lead to the wonderful society that we wish it would. If there was an internal moral compass that was always going to point in the right direction, boom, there you go. You could forget about all this arguing. But realizing that there isn't, that's why going back, remember that human nature is flawed by original sin. If you forget that one point,
all is forgotten.
You're completely muddled. You're in the fog. Then you know you can't just say let human society go the way it will, and it will turn out good. That was only true in the Garden of Eden. That's why Pope John Paul II is so adamant. You've got to keep these three epochs of history in mind: the time before the apple, the time from the apple to the second coming, and what's the third time? Eternity or heaven. And so the political moral debates won't be at all the same in heaven as we have them here. And they weren't the same
in the garden.
For a Garden of Eden. For I heard on a Theology of the Body talk one time, I think it was a Christopher West used this kind of analogy. He says, in the Garden of Eden, you wouldn't have had to put a rule. You didn't need the Ten Commandments for Adam and Eve. You didn't have to say, thou shalt not commit adultery. You could say, well, there was no other women around if it was, no, but no, that's beside the point. Mm-hmm. In Adam's heart, he wouldn't have thought of committing adultery. He had this great love, or even a husband and a wife that are well married together. And you don't have to make a rule that says you shall not sleep with a knife under your pillow, so that you can protect yourself from there's just certain things that are written in the heart. Right. And John Paul is saying if you analyze and you meditate and you can see the Catholic teachings on especially marriage and all, they can be seen as written in the heart. They're not written on the heart now because of original sin, but they make sense that they were by God in the beginning. And later on in the future, heaven, we don't know enough about what heaven will be like, but we can know that it'll have a rejoicing and a beautiful existence of love and happiness and togetherness. So, but that, I want to come back. We'll do a show on Cardinal George, because he has so many wise things to say. But I want to push that thought a little bit further, because I love our church. I love this country. I love the world in which we live. And it all has to come together. And I believe the good Lord is pushing throughout it. You've been listening to Listener Supported, The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
What's there to say when the world makes no sense? Do we search deeper truths or sit on the fence? Can you see? Can you see? Meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is wrought. It's time to be stirred. The time.